figured out that he did it on purpose. He went to visit family in Texas from South Alabama, and he put himself through over 3 days of driving just so I would have to teach this chapter. So I accepted it and laughed about it later. Paul gives a mini marriage seminar in this chapter. He's dealing with circumstances in a very sexually minded city and culture, Corinth. And he had received some comments from Christians there. And he's writing them about some of those comments. It's similar to verses chapters 5 and 6. We know this because of the rendering of verse 1. Now for the matters you wrote about. So these are things that they were writing him about, trying to deal with in the Corinthian church. The first item was, it is good for a man not to marry. In other words, they had given in to some of the culture that was making marriage a sinful thing, and that was making the, even within a marriage union, the requirement of celibacy, no sex. And it was very much a part of the culture there, and it was making its way into the Corinthian church. It's not unusual when you find people going over the edge in one direction to have them rebound in the other direction to an extreme. And at Corinth, sex had become almost a religion. In fact, some suggest that prostitution in the assembly was something that was well known. And so to suggest that we should be moral, they took it to an extreme. We call it asceticism. And there are ascetics mentioned in Colossians and other places. 1 John, a reference to it. And it's making man-made laws for yourself in the name of spirituality. I'm a more spiritual person if I refrain from sex in my marriage, is what they were suggesting. So it's not just the single life that's being discussed. It's the single life that a person could conduct for themselves, even in a marriage relationship. And so he's going to deal with that in a very straightforward way. And I appreciate the fact that we have this as part of our mandate from God. He says, whatever is good for a man is good for a woman in marriage. He says there's nothing wrong with being married. And he says that if you are married, you have a responsibility to the spouse. And there's no question about that. Since there is so much immorality, each man should have his own wife, and each woman her own husband. And of course, that's acknowledging that in a sexual environment, the temptations are very strong. And if you are in a position to think about sex outside of marriage, that's not what God wants. And this is the way to avoid it if you're not married and drawn toward the immorality of sexual activity outside of marriage. On two occasions in my ministry, I raised the possibility to a couple that I was counseling that if they're having difficulty being engaged for 3 or 4 months, and they're being drawn toward an early adventure of sex in any form, they need to move the marriage date Because Paul is going to say it's better to marry than to burn. I alluded to it with my grandson a couple of weeks ago, who's getting married Saturday in Arkansas. Terry's in Oklahoma taking care of some family duties, so Eric and the older children could make a trip together. I will fly to Searcy or Little Rock Thursday and be there for my grandson's wedding. But I told him, if you and Mariana are having trouble with sexuality during this time, move the date up. Change the date. Because it's a real circumstance. And I know of some who've even suggested that we're engaged, so it would be okay because we're engaged to be married. And it is not okay. And this verse has just said it. You should be married. If there's immorality, lust in your heart, you should marry. One man, one wife for life. That's God's desire. And in that marriage, the husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife. And likewise, the wife to her husband. Now that is not telling us that it's her responsibility to cook breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and clean the house, and wash the clothes. And if she can work outside the home, that's an option. There are certain wife responsibilities that she would have in that neutral relationship. That's not what he's talking about. He's talking about a sexual responsibility that a husband and wife have to each other. Because, he says, verse 4, the wife's body does not belong to her alone, but also to her husband. And in the same way, the husband's body does not belong to him alone, but also to his wife. So marriage is the place where sexual activity is God's gift to that marriage couple. It's a gift to a marriage couple. It's the way life comes into the world, but it's also a way of bringing them together in very unique ways, obviously, but in very emotional and very spiritual ways as well. And there's a joy attached to it. There's enjoyment attached to it. And that's alluded to, but it's a responsibility that the husband and the wife have toward each other. Now, we've all heard the expression. Hopefully, we've perhaps even had to use it. I don't feel like it tonight. I have a headache. Or it's been a hard week. Let's not do anything tonight, but let's get rested up and let's get together tomorrow. And those are realistic, common sense realities for a busy married couple. But it's not to be used day after day after day after day after day to shirk, to push away the obligation that a man and a woman married have to each other sexually. It's not a reason, it's not an excuse that needs to find its way over a period of time. He does suggest, verse 5, do not deprive each other except by mutual consent. So that you may devote yourselves to prayer. This thing just changed, didn't it? I think it got louder. Good. Helps you to hear it. A mutual agreement for a spiritual reason. to devote yourself to prayer. Fasting is something similar to that situation. Fasting for a short time to give yourself toward prayer. So he acknowledges that there's some reasoning behind it, but it's a mutual agreement for a spiritual thing. But there's also a warning attached to it. Do not deprive each other except by mutual consent and for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. Then come together again, so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. I think the volume's changing again. The batteries are vacillating, maybe. I don't know. So he's discussing the reality that if one of the two participants in that marriage neglects their sexual responsibility to the other, it's a possibility that Satan will use that and the inability to exert the control that should be exerted to push them to someone else. I'm sorry to tell you, but I know a minister that pushed his wife out of their house with the hope that she would find someone else and he could marry the single person that he had a relationship with in another city before moving to this city. That's a sad admission, but it's the truth. But it acknowledges what this verse is suggesting. Verse 5 is a way that Satan can use something, not a mutual agreement, for a spiritual reason, and Satan can use that to bring about sexual unfaithfulness in that marriage. And it's a real concern that Paul is dealing with. He says, I say this as a concession, not as a command. Now, he's getting ready to say something and offer some advice, if you will, not necessarily based upon his apostle authority, his authority as an apostle, but from his own circumstances, which he has come to realize can be a benefit. But what's he dealt with? There's nothing wrong before God with two people, a man and woman, getting married. And there's nothing wrong with having sexual intercourse in that marriage. So don't think that you've got to become pushed toward the ascetic response that would suggest I'm going to abstain because I'm a spiritually minded person. And for the sake of my relationship with God, I'm going to deprive my spouse of that which is part of the marriage relationship. Paul is very clear. But remember, the only reason it's coming up is because they've written, because they had apparently been told or heard a reference that it's according to God's will that you be celibate. And that word is more at the root of the question than just the idea of whether you're married or not. And so he answers that very clearly. And here's what his concession is. And it's true, what he's about to say. I say this as a concession, not as a command. I wish that all men were as I am. But each man has his own gift from God. One has this gift, another has that gift. Paul is telling us that if you are single, that too is okay with God. It can be a gift from God. Being single can be a gift from God. And he's going to talk in this chapter of what that makes possible. If you're a single person, whether by choice by not finding the person that you wanted to marry or because of the death of a spouse. It frees you from a lot of responsibility to another person. And that's what Paul's going to talk about. You have time without some of the duties that that relationship might otherwise press upon you. And he sees it as a gift from God. And we should see it as a gift from God. Terry has a very well-written book written by someone she met at the Harding Lectureships last fall, written as a single woman to single women. It's outstanding. And it goes through the process of dealing with all the insecurities, the low self-esteem, and all the other things that could be a part of the life of someone who's single, who wanted to be married perhaps, or who once were married and circumstances have changed. But Paul says it can be a gift from God. But marriage is also a gift from God. The worst thing we told our Chinese students, the worst thing that can happen to you in this life is to be married to the wrong person. Don't marry the wrong person. And in China, that may involve not marrying the person that your parents have arranged for you to marry, usually for money, rarely for love. It's for position and support, if you will. It's a gift from God if you're single. But so is the wedding possibility, a gift from God. And so we should not look at them differently. We need to look at ourselves in the mirror and see how that is a gift, how it's an advantage that we might have over someone else and the duties that their life requires as it would relate to a family. Our topic for our Mother's Day lesson today is why have a family? Why have a family? And we're going to honor God, we're going to honor women, we're going to honor mothers by answering that question. Now, your comments, if you want to say something based on those seven verses. I don't blame you. If there's something else to be said, we can say it to Gary in private. You're thinking to yourself, I know for a fact that there's an elder at one time who had a married daughter, and two things occurred in that relationship, both of them not according to the principles taught in these verses. She came to disregard him emotionally and lovingly for a lot of good reasons. And she started withholding her body sexually to her married husband, to her husband to whom she was married. And his recourse was, well, you're not getting a penny from me until we have sex. And then I'm giving you the credit card to go buy groceries. We're not going to eat as it relates to my supporting this family and us buying food to eat or anything else. And both of them were going against the teachings of this verse. One, because of a lack of respect for an unloving husband. And that goes to Ephesians 5, verse 33. And the wife, or the husband, of doing anything he could to force her to be faithful to her marital duty as his wife in this area of their life. Both of them were wrong. But much occurred to get it to that point. It's a real life circumstance. Maybe not to that extent, but it's a real life circumstance in some marriages that have a lot of problems, a lot of issues that they're dealing with. Well, Paul can't stop there because there are others, as I've alluded to, who are in a single relationship. Now, to the unmarried and the widows, some of them are single, they've not married. Others were married, no longer. It is good for them to stay unmarried as I am. But if they cannot control themselves, they should marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. Where does the sexual urge come from? It's a simple answer that we need to realize. It comes from God. It's placed within us. It's not natural for a man or a woman, when drawn chemistry-wise, emotionally, and all the other things that take place in coming to a relationship that perhaps could consider marriage, all of those are part of something that's part of the humanity that we are, but the sexual urge is part of God's design. It's His design. And it's unnatural to not have that, but it's also not according to His plan if we allow it to reign under no control. It needs to be under control. Let me chase an issue quickly because the circumstances are exactly the same. If we believe homosexuality or lesbianism is by nature, then that's a different discussion. But if we believe that there can be part of it that's by nature, but part of it is culture, and what Scripture would say to those who have an interest sexually in someone of the same sex, then you need to temper your lust. You don't need to act upon it. Just like any other single person may have a sexual desire, you cannot, if you're trying to please God, act on that desire. You cannot act upon it because the sexual relationship is for a married man and woman. Husband and wife, you cannot act upon it. And yet I've had conversation with three Christian mothers whose daughters are lesbians. And they're not sure what to do. But they wanted me to be aware of it so that if I were given the opportunity to spend time with them, I would be quick to grab hold of it. And I was. What's the answer ultimately? What causes it? There's a variety of circumstances. I think some of it can be natural. But you can't act upon the desire if you're pleasing to God. And Paul is saying it's okay to be single. It's okay to be a widow or widower. It's okay. And it removes you from a lot of duty that otherwise might be there. My dad was a chemist with DuPont, retired from them. My mom was a trained Erlanger nurse, Chattanooga trained, at Erlanger Hospital. She eventually went to work for those baby doctors in town who were delivering babies like crazy, and she was their head nurse. Eric's wife, Wendy, is a labor and delivery nurse, just as a side note. Mom and Dad conceived 12 children. Two they lost by miscarriage. The one between the oldest and me died because he was so small, he was only 8 hours old when he passed. I was also premature. I had to stay in an incubator 5 weeks to weigh 4 pounds, 4 ounces to go home. The only reason they let her take me home is because they knew she was a trained nurse and would know what to do as far as continuing the necessary things to let me grow a few more pounds. I say that to say this. One of their best friends said to Mom and Dad one day, "You do know what causes this, right? You're a nurse and a chemist. Figure it out." And without hesitation, my mother said this. Some people invest in real estate. They invest with the goal of making lots of money. We are going to invest in children. And they did. I'm the second of 9 who lived. They had unmarried pregnant women in their home for many weeks through a local agency. We had 3 or 4 young men our age that just appeared often for breakfast because they were there so late with us as their children. They just spent the night. And when I wrote something to be read at my dad's funeral, we had those 3 men sign it as if they were our children, because we treated them as if they were our brothers in the flesh. Of course, Mom and Dad did. Each of them spoke at her funeral, which I directed. There's nothing wrong with being married and having sex to bring children into that relationship. But neither is there anything wrong if you're not married or if you're single again, for whatever the reason. Want to add to that? I don't want to pass up opportunities for you to add to it.
More than married.
Yes. Let me make an announcement now. Domingo de Jesus passed away last night. She's Diana Cruz's housemate that we've been praying for. She passed into eternity last night because of bone cancer. Terry and I and Lizella and Diana and 2 hospice nurses and I think some 2 or 3 others were there about 8 weeks ago when we managed to baptize her in her bathtub. Today I'm very thankful for that. It was not an easy process. It was not an easy process. She made it very comfortable for us because it's something she knew she wanted to do. So we celebrate that today. Now, to the married, verse 10, I give this command, not I, but the Lord. So Jesus spoke on this subject, is what that verse is telling us. This isn't just from me, it's from God. The other was more of his advice, not a command, but advice. A wife must not separate from her husband. What was happening at Corinth is there were some of the marriage relationship apparently, who after they married, one of them became a Christian. One of them became a Christian. And so they were wondering, if this becomes difficult, do I have the right to separate from this unbeliever? And by the way, there are some who would suggest that if they're a longtime unfaithful Christian, and in principle, this could apply to that as well. A wife must not separate from her husband. But if she does, she must remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. And a husband must not divorce his wife. Paul goes back to the clear understanding of the ideal that Jesus teaches during his ministry. One man, one woman for life. And the only reason for scriptural divorce, as we would say it, is sexual unfaithfulness. So they were saying, what should I do? To the rest I say this, I, not the Lord. So this is his instruction. If any brother has a wife who is not a believer, and it can be vice versa, and she is willing to live with him, he must not divorce her. So you have a believer and a non-believer. Do I have the right to divorce an unbeliever, a non-believer? I'm suggesting, he says, that you should not. If they're willing, if they're not demanding a separation, if they're not leading to a divorce, you don't make that choice. Live with them. And if a woman has a husband, he turns it around, who is not a believer and he is willing to live with her, she must not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband has been sanctified through his wife, and the unbelieving wife has been sanctified through her believing husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. Now, that is a difficult verse. I don't care how you look at it. But you've got to understand what the word sanctified and holy mean. It's the same word in the original language as hagios. It means being set apart for special use. So the unbelieving husband or the unbelieving wife has been set apart for special use because of their Christian mate. And so have the children. So have the children. Some make this say something that refutes so many other principles found in Scripture, suggesting that this person is guaranteed a place in heaven because of the believing spouse. That's not what it's teaching. But the Christian has an influence over the unbeliever. And if they stay together, it can have an influence over their set apart for special service children. And what it's saying is this. If you will live with that person as a husband or wife, treat them as a husband or wife, you have the opportunity of converting them. Don't demand a separation because you can convert that person. Turn with me. I don't like to do this, but I must. 1 Peter 3. I don't like to leave a chapter or a book that we're studying and treat it as a topical study to where you don't learn what that book teaches. I don't want you to know everything the Bible teaches about a subject that's introduced in the Corinthian letter. That's never my method. But I can't ignore 1 Peter 3 because it relates exactly to these verses. Wives, in the same way, be submissive to your husbands, so that if any of them do not believe the word, they may be won over without talk by the behavior of their wives when they see the purity and reverence of your lives. Now that's what he says we should do. A Christian wife to an unbelieving husband. Your life can convert him if you never study the Bible with him. That's what it's saying. Your reverence, your purity can win that person over without words. Is it probable? Not necessarily. But whose fault is it if your purity and reverence and your being a good Christian spouse and he doesn't do anything about it? It's not your fault, is what it's suggesting without saying it overtly. Here's something else. When I approach these verses, here's what these two verses do not say. Now, we just looked at what they do say. What do they not say? They don't tell the Christian wife to lead. The husband is head of the house. They don't tell her to lead. They don't tell her to leave, do they? Don't lead, don't leave. They also don't tell her to nag him to death. That without words is important to see. There was a time in our family, and I'll not say anything but the necessary things, but on a Sunday morning when it was time to get ready to go to class and worship, the mother-in-law, not Terry, the mother-in-law who was at that house would go to the trouble to set up a record player, put it in the hall outside the room where her son-in-law, who was not faithful to the church, was living, or sleeping rather, and playing that music, Christian hymns, so he could hear it. Folks, that's nagging. Now, to listen to them in the house, to listen to them in the living room, to listen to them in her bedroom where she was sleeping that weekend, it's nagging. And it doesn't work. Pure, reverential Christian life can convert without words that unbelieving or that non-believing husband. She is not to lead in the fourth item attached to that. She is not told to be the head of the house. Don't lead, don't leave, don't nag. This isn't permission for you to be the head of the house. Now, husband and wife, it's a partnership. It's a companionship. The woman was created from the side of man with the goal of coming alongside the man and participating in a home relationship. But the husband is head of that house. He's the head of the house, and he will answer to God for that. But it's a foolish husband who doesn't let his wife, perhaps a mother, participate in the rearing of those who live in that home. And especially participate in the spiritual direction of the raising of Christian children. But these verses certainly fit alongside, if you will, what Paul is teaching the church at Corinth, and today teaching us. Let me read you before, well, time is gone. I was going to very quickly repeat the main points that time is gone. We'll come back to a little bit of this next week There's a couple of items we don't need to leave out, but you go read the second half of chapter 7. It's fairly clear, but let's come back to it and address a couple of things before we leave the chapter. Thank you.